Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we're covering Iron Man 2. I'm joined by Matt Graham. How are you, Matt?
I'm good, thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Matt's here in the Sydney at the Tech Penthouse, and we across the other side of the globe via the miracle of modern communications. Jason Diamond, how are you, sir?
Brilliant, thank you.
So it must be late evening in New York, is that correct?
It is 10:30 at night, yes.
It is good as damn it night here, given what miserable weather we're having in Sydney at the moment. But I don't want to break the illusion of everyone that thinks that Australia is always sunny, but I hate to break it. It is actually occasionally rainy. So this is a great film to discuss, Iron Man 2. We like to discuss, in recent times, we've always picked a film and a topic. And what we thought we'd discuss with Iron Man is maybe something a little unusual. We thought, in addition to the discussion we will have about, obviously, the suits and the 3D and stuff, I thought it was interesting the scope of a film this size in terms of green screen and how they actually shoot for effects. And so one of the things we've got the benefit of this week is American Cinematographer came up with an absolutely cracking article about the production of Iron Man. Now, a lot's been written by, well, lots of people, including ourselves, about post and VFX on this. In fact, we have an interview with Ben Snow on FX Guide as a podcast, and also FX Guide TV with the guys from DNEG and Fuel. So we'll be discussing the digital side of it. But I do think that, Jason, it's a massive undertaking, a film like this, and no more is that visible than when you start seeing some of the behind-the-scenes actual builds for the sets, because a lot of them are set extensions.
Just out of a practical set thing that stuck out at me is the Flushing Meadow Park scene where they were having the Stark Expo in Queens is actually right down the street from my house, and it looks nothing like that.
Well, we're gonna come back and discuss that set in particular, because I think it's one of the really good examples of what we can do. And I also think it's kind of, you know, in a film like this, wouldn't you agree, Matt, like where it's so dominated by the brilliant work of people like ILM and stuff, that you kind of almost lose sight of what was live action versus what was just, you know, it's easy to just write everything off as being digital, but there's a huge amount of complex live action for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was definitely broken into two schools of thought. I mean, I know a lot of the live action and the dialogue, and it did have a lot heavier dialogue than I think the first one did. That was a lot of ad-lib stuff, but when it came to the visual effects, it was all previs by Third Floor, and apparently the second unit, you know, really shot to those previs.
Yeah, we absolutely love the work of the Third Floor guys in LA. They're really, really good. So look, let's before we get into the effects, I'm dying to, let's just, as we always do, a quick summary of what we thought of the film. I thought it was really good. I was genuinely impressed with the fact that they managed to walk that line between being the sequel exactly the same as the first and jumping the sofa and coming up with something that I didn't want to see. So I really liked it a lot. What about you, Jason?
I did not like it as much as I liked the first one. My only problem being that I felt like the pacing was a little weird. Like they were just sort of, they would set something up and then rush through it, pay it off, and then turn it around into something else, which is fine sometimes, but I think my problem was that, and I don't know if this is going to be part of a trilogy or what, but it felt like a second film in terms of a little darker, a little more, you know, deeper inside personal stuff. And, you know, Tony Stark is, you know, spoiler alert, obviously we have to talk about the film plot, is he's dying from the palladium poisoning, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse, like in the first act. And he's still, like, super snarky, downy guy. And it seemed like the character didn't ever really turn over into, like, okay, I'm really worried here, except for, like, a couple glimpses here and there. And I think that was a problem for me. It just felt a little too on the nose for his character. On a whole, I mean, the action was great. All the effects were, for the most part, really spot on. And all the acting was good. I mean, I love Sam Rockwell in anything. And, you know, actually, David Strapinas pointed out to me before I saw it, and it totally made sense, that there's a scene when he gets Mickey Rourke out of prison and they have dinner in the white hangar. And they never mention it, but if you look at Sam Rockwell's hands, they're stained with self-tanner.
And yes, I noticed that, yes.
That makes, as David pointed out to me, that says so much about his character beyond anything else they could possibly say, that it was, neither of us could determine who came up with that.
I noticed that on the second viewing. I've seen the film twice, and I noticed on the second viewing. I agree. That was, I looked at it, and I just broke up laughing when I noticed it the second time around. Matt, what did you think of the film?
I thought it was great. I mean, it definitely felt rushed and, you know, wasn't a chip off the original one, which I loved and I thought was the best film of, what was it, 2008. But this would be the most anticipated film of 2010, and overall I think it failed to deliver, mostly on the story side of things. It felt really rushed. Production was advanced. There were so many little convenient moments of, you know, the whole discovery of a giant map of Stark Expo 70s era that happened to be lying around the office, that happened to be the key, whatever. It just felt a bit contrived. And like you said, Jason, the whole imminent death, which just fizzled very quickly, and oh, look, there's now a magical cure, let's move on. It just felt like they were going through the motions and setting up for the third film.
I mean, we're not going to get, you know...
But the first one, sure, I mean, now we know the character and where he's going. The first one felt, you know, like he could die any moment and there was challenges. Whereas this one, every time there was a challenge, it was just overcome. Like, you know, when Whiplash is breaking out of prison and that guard puts his hand on his shoulder to stop him, you know, this huge pause, and then he breaks his arm and the place blows up. And it's like, what? Was that a dramatic pause? Was this that just a horrid moment?
I like that bit. I like the whole thing. I'm going to disagree with you on this, but we're going to move on to effects because I can see I'm outnumbered by you guys. So look, the film did have some changes late in the game. In particular, the ending was changed to have Whiplash sort of reappear at the end, which fell on ILM to kind of come up with a bunch of stuff near the end. But let's start at the other end of the film with the Monaco sequence, which was Dineg. And I say that because there was obviously a bit of stuff in Russia before that. But in terms of big effect sequences, that car racing sequence and the subsequent flipping and crashing of cars and fight sequence, what do we actually think of it, just that sequence as a visual effects sequence? Because it had to perform a couple of really quite tricky things from a visual effects point of view. What do you think, Jason?
I had not as a nod here, but I had watched the FX Guide TV interview with both Dineg and Fuel, I believe it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I sort of, before I saw the movie, so I had a little tip off of what I was looking for in the Monaco sequence. And I really liked that sequence, actually, from an effects point of view. I really liked the suitcase idea and the way that they talked about having to make sure it worked both mechanically and from an effects point of view. They had to re-edit the sequence a bunch of times to get the timing right for the build. And I believe they did a full digital double for that, just because otherwise it would have been impossible to match Downey's performance.
So what you're talking about is in the sequence where he actually puts on the suit from the suitcase.
Yeah. Once he puts his hands into the suitcase, they basically did a digital double because it would be almost impossible to re-time his performance.
With the exception of his head, yeah.
Yeah.
That's just a lot about VFX films these days, where the VFX are now playing a big part in the edit, and they're recutting, you know, the drama to make sure the VFX get a spotlight and are literally driving the story in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a couple of things about that sequence I thought was impressive. I think the believability of a suit expanding from the suitcase, it's a really hard ask when somebody says, yeah, it's a suitcase and it becomes a whole suit, and then somebody quietly sort of says to themselves, bloody hell, how am I going to do this? Because it has to be believable. We discussed that in the FX Guide TV app. The other thing was, I actually felt like the composites and stuff were really, really good. Now, they walked out some 40 by 60 foot frames of green screen for that stuff, so they were shooting exterior. But, you know, the stuff with Stark in his busted up... Now, let's be clear about this. This wasn't a Formula One race, but it was a... sort of like a Formula One historical something race. Apparently the Formula One fans have got really upset when I said it was a Formula One race. It isn't. It's the every off-year race. But anyway, whatever it is. I'm going to call it an F1 Formula One car, but I apologize and I know I'm making a mistake in advance.
Racing around an F1 track. Let's just call it that.
So, yeah, so they were shooting green screen for a lot of those sequences. And as we said, there was complete body doubles. And not only that, but there were complete re-lensing of some of Whiplash's shots. Now, I think... I don't know this for a fact. I think I was aware of one of those. It's a long shot looking down at Whiplash when the cars are sort of busting up behind him and he's walking towards
the Michael Bay explosion shot.
Yeah, and that felt...
I like that shot.
I liked it too. I think it was the only shot that I would say, well, that looked like it had been relensed. I think it was a thematically, editorially, and visually interesting shot. I could sort of, from a VFX point of view, it felt like it might have been relensed.
It definitely stood out a lot. I mean, for me, I didn't like it because it, you know, took me out of that. Everything else was impeccable up until that point.
But I think the whole sort of whiplash sequence that, and the way that the cars were flipped and the way that they had that lovely kind of edge line where the metal was hot from being cut through.
Yeah, that was really solid.
Really, really nice. And you know what? It was a good sequence. Like, we needed to see Stark vulnerable. You know, he was obviously slightly pushing the envelope of believability that you can be rammed by a Bentley and get up and walk away from it. You know, I'm not
quite sure how he had
bionic legs, but
from a VFX point of view, it was like four times too.
Yeah, exactly. But the cutting up of the Bentley was terrific. It had, you know, good comic timing. But I think just the keys were just, I mean, at no point in that sequence did I like look at and say someone had a digital haircut, that someone had shrunk the keys in tight. And with various bits of smoke and dust and stuff that were happening out there on the track, the green screens, while, you know, I'm sure lit well, would have still suffered from having quite a lot of contamination. So they were really, really good keys. They did cover, just, we're going to discuss a lot about camera work this week. So to shoot those green screen sequences, they did have green screens on location. They also hung really, really big silks or kind of white diffusers from frames over the top of the area so that the light was a little more filtered to the actors, to the environment, making it a little less high con. But, you know, felt exterior, felt well, really well lit and incredibly well keyed for my money. What do you guys think about, like, from that sequence? There was no obvious points that I thought that, for example, when it went to CG Robert Downey Jr., it, at no point did it feel like it had, we suddenly shifted gears to effect shots. They felt just as real to me.
Yeah, I mean, the animation combining, you know, a full CG character with the live action character was terrific. I mean, they really worked well together, and obviously being connected by the digital whips. And I think, as mentioned in the FX guide story, Mickey Rourke didn't have much whips training, so removing those whips and adding digital ones and making them work between the two characters, I thought was done really well.
I guess we should say right at this point that there was no suit on set that was a hero suit for Iron Man. Whenever you saw the suit, the whole suit, it was nothing but the digital suit. And I think that was really impressive. Like, I really did feel that the work that's been done by ILM, and we'll discuss this, I guess, a bit later when we specifically discuss the suit, but I just... The suit that was done by ILM was really well matched by Deneg's work, because Deneg did the suit at the Monaco environment. And just like ILM, I felt it had exactly the right anisotropic shaders, the way that the paint texture was working. It just felt really, really good to me. And just, honestly, I just couldn't complain. I couldn't look at that suit and say, maybe...
The damage was fantastic. I mean,
just,
like,
superb.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't, at a certain point, like when you would see when the mask flipped back and you saw his face, you could almost say, oh, they had a real suit on set, but they didn't.
Now, there was a what they call the football suit, which was, if you ever watched American football, you'll know the sort of padding for the shoulders that you have for an American gridiron
right.
type player. So there are occasions where the actors would be wearing something basically from the chest up to give them some kind of basic physicality. But these suits from there on down were the what I'm going to call the the Pirates of the Caribbean dot suits. So if you've ever seen any behind the scenes from Pirates of the Caribbean, you'll know ILM perfected the single camera, which is the hero camera, tracking and the ability to therefore replace with digital. And so for the latter stuff in Tony's apartment and stuff, that's what people were pretty much wearing. I think one thing that that we just shouldn't dismiss is the cameras that they shot with in Monaco, because I was just astounded when I heard this. They were shooting a lot of that car stuff. They had a hotted up Porsche and they put some cameras on it. They had two VistaVision cameras and two 5Ds, and that just killed me. That it was just like, think of the range of cameras you could use right now, 5Ds to VistaVisions. I mean, that's got to be either end of the spectrum.
But they said they didn't use the 5, they only use a 5D for reference, though. They weren't compositing with it or anything.
No, they weren't using it for hero plate stuff, but it just really amused me that if you're going out to shoot stuff, that you'd be like, because this film is, you said it, Matt, one of the most highly anticipated of the year. they could add any cameras they wanted, right? They weren't putting 5Ds on because they'd run out of budget and can only put 5Ds. They just wanted some really small compact cameras, and they fit the bill. And once again, we're seeing this enormous growth in SLRs in places you wouldn't have expected.
Yeah, I mean, Yannick says that was Yannick's idea, trying to get, you know, obviously terrific footage to replicate. I'm not too sure. Yeah, I know Jed Wright from DNEG mentioned they didn't use any in the film, but I think I read somewhere in an American Cinematography article that they might have used a couple of 12-frame snippets of impacts and stuff from the 5Ds. And, yeah, you can throw a couple of grand camera away easily and get some amazing shots. I mean, you obviously wouldn't want to be doing that with a Millennium.
Yeah, you can really trash the camera when it's on the side of a car when you know the camera only costs a couple of grand in a film that's costing millions to make. So let's, unless anyone's got anything else on Monaco, I think we just definitely give that a huge tick. DNEG once again showing why it's one of the top visual effects houses in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say I liked how the electricity on the whips looked kind of old school. There was a little bit of a hand drawn feel to it.
Almost had that Back to the Future.
Ghostbusters.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, it was good, wasn't it? It's funny that and yet if you actually looked at the mechanism, it was quite a weird mechanism. I looked at some of the close up shots. The second viewing kind of made myself look down at his hands and stuff, and they were really quite weird production design pistol grip type things. They weren't like a you know, you'd hold a drumstick. That's how I imagine you'd hold a whip handle. These things were more like a fist that was holding a handle that you'd pull for, an emergency hatch.
They said they were designed after lightsabers.
Yeah, well, I think it was designed after lightsabers, but not in terms of the grips. The hand grips were like completely the opposite. They were like you'd hold on a certain underground subways. That, you know, like, I mean, like a fist holding a horizontal, not vertical, if a drumstick is vertical. Good work with the whips. All around great. So let's cut to this bit where Tony Stark drops in on his expo. So what I think is really interesting is the director had a desire to try and shoot this as much as possible, as real as possible, and wherever possible would shoot the actors. So this wasn't shot digitally. This was shot on like 500T mainly, Kodak stock. And I think they used some 50D for some of the effects work, but, you know, primarily Vision stock. Some 5217 and 5219, 200T and 500T. The green screen stuff for that drop sequence, you know, which I think, by the way, must have changed because in the promo,
there's a couple of scenes that
she tosses his hat out, a helmet out, and then says, "Go get him, champ." And that wasn't in the film.
I'm sure there'll be a director's cut and Blu-ray in just 6 months' time.
Okay. But so even that first drop sequence, that flying sequence, he was, we had an actor on green screen shot on a vast green psych, and then of course they were driving, which is interesting because you really didn't need any actor reference unless you were going to put in the film the bit where he doesn't have his helmet. So I'm wondering, you know, whether that was only shot because you wanted his face, because obviously if he's not ever getting his helmet, his helmet is on with the point he jumps out of the aircraft, there is no performance really to capture. I mean, it's not like it's a detailed, you're not like you're tapping into Robert Janet Jr.'s ability to fly any better than you are ILM's guys to fly. But leaving that aside, the landing at the expo and then the actual expo sequence itself was, I think, a great kind of rock and roll moment, helped along by the great Australian band AC/DC. But it was exactly what you wanted, I think. Really big, gutsy, ballsy, you know, get the fans. I mean, if you're a 16-year-old kid watching this film, you'd have been like, yeah.
You're punching the air at the end of the first one, so you needed Iron Man to be back in the second one with the same kind of balls-to-the-wall adrenaline rush.
Now, we dragged Jason into this podcast a little late because Cannon was going to be joining us, and I'm sure if he was here, he'd have said that there was a Hulk thump ripoff for Iron Man landing on the stage. Still, it was a pretty dramatic, cool sequence. Let's discuss, though, the expo, because a lot of green screen, a lot of big stuff both inside and out. And I wanted, if we could, to discuss that. Let's discuss it first in terms of the sequence, and then we'll get into some of the technical stuff behind it. He's obviously in a fully digital suit that then unwinds to be his dinner jacket setup. Jason, how did you feel that sequence played out visual effects-wise?
I liked it, except for, and they do this consistently throughout the film, so clearly somebody thought about it. On that land, that really hard landing, from a, and I know I'm being super nitpicky because it's you know, it's a comic book movie, but when he hits the ground at that velocity, I mean, there was no deceleration at all, and he just slams into the ground, and there's no impact on the ground at all, and not to mention the complete deceleration trauma that would have happened with his head ending up in the feet of that suit.
But, okay,
it's a really good suit.
But I'm being completely insanely nitpicky.
I thought the same thing, but I was happy to go with it because I thought it was just literally a dramatic entrance device. And
absolutely, and they do it with every robot.
Yeah.
Every suit that lands, so I'm just saying film. So clearly they thought about it.
Yeah, I think it's just a stylistic choice to make him decelerate unrealistically quickly. But it didn't piss me off because, you know, I've seen films where they've actually cut frames out to give the illusion of that happening. And, I mean, let's face it, that's what they did with the Star Wars doors coming up and down. It does give it a very robotic, very hardcore kind of feel. I can cut a filmmaker some slack on that. I don't feel that was...
I'm just being nitpicky. It didn't take me out of the film or anything. I was just like, whoa. I remember I saw it in the trailer too, so I was already ready for it. But anyway, the sequence was very well done, and obviously completely reminds you of the character right off the bat of who Tony Stark is and his personality and how he feels about his contribution to world peace.
Yeah, I think it was great. I think. I enjoyed it in the film. I enjoyed it kind of more, actually, when I started studying some of the stats coming off that set. Now, I should point out that there are really two sets that we're talking about here because there's the interior stage set and then there's the exterior expo park area. But in both cases, the expo lighting stuff was just enormous because there was a considerable amount of green screen set up. But by the same token, you're mounting green screen with a rock concert because, Matt, this is rock concert lighting. This is just full-on, if AC/DC had been playing, this is the lighting rigs they would have wanted for thumping around on stage.
Definitely. I mean, they had to, you know, this is Tony Stark, the richest man in the world. They need to make sure whatever he's got there is the latest and greatest. And they certainly brought out the latest and greatest of concert lighting for the scene, as well as, you know, your cinema lighting. And they were using the visuals on the back with the Versa tubes, which were freaking cool. I really want to get some of those for home.
Yeah, let's discuss those Versa tubes because they were really interestingly played with in this film. In fact, it was probably one of the lighting department and DOP's principal kind of cool things. Now, you might have seen these at the 2009 Academy Awards or the this year's Super Bowl, but you'd also see it in concerts, the police and other people. There's information on the website of the company that makes it, but basically the way these work is these are things that look very much like a fluoro tube. Yet, Jason, they actually act a bit like a video monitor. Do you want to explain?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. I saw these at a television station called Fuse that's right by my office and by Madison Square Garden in here in New York. And I couldn't actually figure out how they did it. I thought it was some sort of, like you said, a fluoro like map, some sort of mapping they could do on the tube. But it's actually there's LEDs in the tubes, and they has each tube has a row of RGB LEDs, and they said it says to think of the tube as a small slice of a TV display. So it basically maps a computer monitor directly to the pixels in the tube. So you can, I'm assuming you can program them to fit a large array of tubes, a single tube. It doesn't seem like there would be a limit to how you could program it.
Yeah, so if you were to think of a bank of tubes and maybe you've got, you know, 30 or 40 tubes up, that's giving you a vertical resolution of 30 lines. It sounds appalling, and it is in a sense, except for that's the look. The look is this very kind of, low-tech, high-tech look where you're getting the aliasing from having a what is effectively an incredibly low line count, but you get all of the color fidelity of having control over the color, and you can have video playing, and it becomes very blocky, but then it becomes very blocky in a kind of cool, hip kind of way. So that was used at the back of the stage. So whenever it looks like a giant monitor, it wasn't a 3D monitor, it wasn't a 3D insertion at that point. It actually is these Versa tubes. But what's really interesting to me is that this was also the same thing that they used when they wanted to do Tony Stark's heads-up display on his face. They would actually have the Versa tube sitting in front of him, and they'd be punching in stuff that was causing the tubes to not flicker, but, you know, produce images, which of course then would play on Tony's face. So when you've got a close-up of him inside the suit, and you're going to have obviously the terrific heads-up display work that we loved so much in Iron Man 1, what's causing the contact lighting on his face is not some post effect. It's actually contact lighting from the Versa tubes. And there are so many places throughout this film that they were used.
That's a really interesting addition of the tubes in the HUD display. And obviously the HUD in the first one, I think, was it the Orphanage did it for the first Iron Man?
Is just freaking awesome.
Yeah, everyone fell in love with that, and it was such a cool thing. So having that back again and then upping it another level with this kind of practical lighting's really cool.
So let's take that as like a set piece, though they were, as I say, used throughout the whole film to help the visual effects work. To give you an idea of some of the other stuff that was on set for the expo stuff, there is a big normal light that you might rent for like $500 a day, which is called a Bigmo, which is a 20K Fresnel. So this is basically a lens that has the property of trying to throw more light forward. But a 20K is, Jace, a big light.
Yeah, 20K is a that's a big light. You're not just picking one of those up for like your independent film or even your college thesis.
No, they're as heavy as all get out, and they are your classic big quartz tungsten light fitting, the sort of thing that you'd imagine that you'd had. And so for that set, the Tony Stark Expo set, they actually had 20 of those suckers. So it's 20 20Ks, 34K super light, soft light. So this is before we get into the kinoflows per se. There's like another 44 of the kinoflows. Now, kinoflows are literally fluorescent tubes, unlike the ones we were talking about before, which were look like a fluorescent tube but actually have LEDs inside them. But the big kinoflows, often used for lighting green screen, they had 44 of those, 8 of the Luma panels, which are very similar, and then another 12 kinoflows, which were the four banks with super green in them. And I think this is a point worth discussing because we don't discuss this quite enough, I don't think. The ability to get really good keys and the ability to do really good work is helped enormously by what's coming off set. And so when you talk about a kinoflow, which is, you know, in an office you've got overhead lights, well, you might have a bank that would have, you know, 8 of those tubes in them, but they're not just any tubes. For lighting the green screen, as they did with the massive amount of green screen that was in this film, you're actually putting in special coloured lamps. In other words, you're putting in a green tube that's giving out pretty much a 525 nanometer spike. So obviously visible light goes from like, 300 something up to about, 500 and something, 700 and something. And at green is kicking in at around 500, 525. And so by narrowing the spike and giving a really solid green signal at that point in the spectrum, you're getting a very, very solid green screen because you're lighting it with green light. But these have to be particularly made lights because you want to have a very clean green signal. You want that nanometer to be a narrow kind of band that doesn't contaminate anything else. And also, you need it to be strong because if you're limiting it to just part of the visible light spectrum, you need to be really pumping it up. And so when you're doing green screen work, you can light a green screen with normal kinos. And I'm assuming, Jace, you would normally light with normal kinos, or do you use green tubes when you're doing effects work?
I've not used the green tubes, and in retrospect, I probably should have at times. But, I mean, looking on their site, they have these massive walls of the green and the blue tubes. I mean, I try to shoot daylight balance if I can, which is nice with the kinos because you can get daylight bulbs.
Yeah, I mean, I've shot with both green. We shot some stuff, stunt stuff with green, and but we also shoot with normal daylight, don't we, Matt?
Yeah, for the green tubes, I think they seem to work better on your bigger green screens. I mean, this green screen was, I think, 600 by 200 feet. So certainly not small. Working with the green tubes on a smaller green screen with less drop-off from the, you know, keyable item, it seems to get a bit more spill in. I find that going with your daylight ones, for example, would be a bit better and easier on the spill.
The other thing that I think is really amazing, there's two other lighting things I want to come back to, but you'd mentioned the size of that green screen. Like, you know, how do you rig a green screen like that? And I used to wonder that, like, how the hell do you build? And what's the standard, the standard process for doing that now is literally you just get shipping containers. So you've seen a normal big shipping container on the back of a truck driving past you on the freeway. Well, imagine you get a lot of those and you just build a huge walled section out of shipping containers outside. That is the structure, because it's actually relatively easy to do. They're incredibly stable. You can't pull them over or blow them over. And of course, you just need trucks to bring them in and stack them up. And they stacked a lot of shipping containers to make this huge area that was being used, which they then hung the green screen on. Because quite frankly, you know, we have problems with green screens blowing over, and we're talking like 40 by 60s, not what you're talking about.
Well, the wind's not going to have those going anywhere. They did the same thing on Pirates as well, didn't they? ILM set out in the car park and stacked up shipping containers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the standard method now for building a major structure. Just haul in, you know, 300 shipping containers and build a wall of shipping containers on top of each other and around in an arc, and they're as stable as all get out, and relatively cheap compared to building anything as solid as a shipping container structure to hang stuff off.
So no waste. You have no construction waste.
No, and then it's just pack them up and ship them out once you've finished burning them, exploding them, or filming them. Okay, so let's go back to the lighting for a second. So we've only talked about lighting up the green screen, and we haven't really talked about lighting up the actors in front of that. So to get the rock and roll AC/DC type stuff that we were talking about, they swung in about 22 Bad Boys. And if you don't know what a Bad Boy is, that is your classic Aerosmith, you know, moving lights that are on a motorized thing with gobos and optical wheels, and these are just really, really, really bright projector type point spotlights, except for the fact that, as I say, they're on a motorized control. They can do 540 degree pans, they can do tilts of up to 270 degrees, and this is astonishing to me, they're 40% optically efficient out the front, which basically means of all the light, because, you know, on those big 20Ks we were talking about before, we're like half or less than maybe a third of the light efficiency out the front of a 20K. But these Bad Boys are just very, very efficient at pumping the light straight out in a kind of narrow spot that's like about 7 degrees wide. And those are the sort of beams of light that gave it the rock and roll kind of look. But it wasn't just those 22. They had another 16 of what's a kind of a smaller version of that, which are the Alpha Profile 1200s. Have you used those, Jason? The smaller
Clay Packy whatever they're called.
Yeah,
I have not. I've been on many a quote unquote rock and roll stage where initially with what I always saw was the Verilite, which is actually, I think, was the precursor to all these, and I think an initial investor and partner in Verilite was Phil Collins. Funny enough. He probably makes more money from that at times from licensing for other gigs than some record sales. But, yeah, I mean, they're great. Those are great lights. Like you said, given the range of motion that they can do and the programmability, I mean, you can get whole banks to do, you know, exactly matched moves. And, I mean, lighting technicians who program those are – I mean, it's akin to programming, you know – it's a motion control rig, basically.
Yeah. Synchronized multiple robotic heads, effectively.
Yeah.
Now, that's given us the rock and roll lighting. We still haven't actually lit up the actors yet, which I just think is extraordinary given how much light they've already got out of the trucks, as it were. So what's interesting for that is the source makers. Now, you've probably seen source makers. These are enormous 10x10, 10K quartz halogen-filled cubes. Think of it like a balloon, basically the best way to describe it. And these are really, really big cubic sort of puffed up white-looking things that can sometimes hang down, or they can be actually filled up to float up with guys from beneath. But these, sometimes you'll hear space lights said. These are just enormous. The source makers are just enormous ambient light generators. They just provide a huge amount of diffused light. They're not directional because they're just this big white-looking blob, or blimp, I guess is the way to describe it. But they're pretty... When you see these shots in, like, American Cinema, those are the things you kind of notice, that somebody's rigged up, like, a dozen of these suckers to light up enormous areas. I mean, there's going to be, obviously, individual lights for the actors, especially on their close-ups. And we mentioned already the enormous... VersaTube wall on the back. I think they had 80 tubes on the back wall for that sequence, though they obviously had less in other sequences. But that just gives you an idea of some of the scope. And so lighting up the green screen really well, but then lighting up stuff in the foreground to sort of sell it. I think it's easy to imagine that in visual effects, you just say, well, you'd shoot them on green screen and everything else would be put in. Well, that's absolutely not the case. But by the same token, it wasn't like they shot everything and then just had to roto to put the stuff in. There was like some really dedicated guys working on getting good levels out of the green screen and producing the kind of quality stuff that they did. Now, by contrast, I think it's really interesting that what I assumed was a green screen and wasn't was Tony's apartment. That was done in a completely different, interesting fashion.
Yeah, I mean, just using a whopping big translite. This picture I've got in front of me from American Cinematography is just huge. They've got a little person in the bottom of it to give you some sense of scale. And, you know, they backlit that and then had a whole heap of luma panels in front to give ambient daylight spill back into the apartment. But that's a whopping big set.
Yeah, I've shot doing this technique, and interestingly, I was talking to a director at an Avid event this last, whatever it was, like on Friday, and he's done exactly the same thing. He finds it to be really good to basically get matte paintings or elements and put them on a canvas. His point, and I presume it was the same for Iron Man, was you can get so much in the way of gorgeous, defocused, shallow depth of field shots without ever having to hit effects, because if you light up a translite behind somebody and then you have a shallow depth of field, you get these lovely, beautiful shots. The light creeps around their face. You have no problems with keying. You have no problems with fine hair detail. No problems in any of the close-ups. Now, in the wide shots, if you have to add stuff back into the matte painting to bring it to life, so, for example, if you had a night shot outside Tony's apartment and you had a night translite out there, you may want to add in on a wider shot, because it would be more in focus, some little lights moving to indicate that it was alive and not a dead environment. But nevertheless, you can afford to do that because you've already got most of the work done by the giant translite. And I think, I mean, this is not uncommon. They use them on The Matrix. I remember seeing them on there, like skylines and stuff. But I mean, I guess for most people, what we're talking about is the thing that you see behind the late night compere when they have the shot of, you know, New York City behind Dave Letterman or whatever. That's just a very simple version of this. This is a much, as you say, Matt, much, much larger version. But it does give you a lot in camera, which I think is, you know, is significant.
It'd probably be a cost-effective way of approaching it as well, because it's not as if this translite's just going to disappear. We know there's going to be a third film, and then we're probably going to have Tony's apartment reappear in a later S.H.I.E.L.D. film. So this having this asset lying around for future use and having a set method, I know there's a Tilly drama here in Australia that you do rear projection, and they're in like their fourth season now, and they use a similar kind of method. Get it in camera, reuse the asset, and save yourself some money on maybe not this project, but definitely the next couple of series.
Well, I remember going on.
Well, also,
you're gone.
No, go ahead, Mike.
I was gonna say, I went on set on Star Trek in the days of Voyager, and I remember just, you know, loving seeing the star, the black cloth with the little that little reflective quartzy, I'm not going to say diamonds because obviously weren't, but you know, imagine a plastic diamond stuck on this. And so when they just shined light on it, they would get lovely twinkles and stuff off it. And of course, that meant that their mess hall, their sort of 10 forward or whatever, would have lovely, you know, stars outside the window, because most of the time they didn't need them to streak and stuff. It was just incidental, so it wasn't black outside the windows. And it is remarkable how well that works. What were you going to say, Jase?
I was just going to say, you know, if you do the math, you say, what are we going to do with the shot and how? I mean, I'm sure obviously they're designing their shots beforehand. So you say, well, we don't need to waste the money on green screen and all the labor to do that. And it's time intensive. Let's just do it. We'll pay for it now. We'll have it, like you said, Matt. And it's just, you know, when you say cut, the shot's done. You move on. Print it.
I think Matt also made an interesting point earlier. Did I hear you saying that a lot of this stuff was improvised?
Yeah, a lot of the drama shall we call it, drama sequences were improvised. So I guess it would add that flexibility. The actors are free to move around, not constrained by, you know, edge of green screens or pools of light. You know, light the whole thing, have a backdrop there and ready to go. And, yeah, much more flexibility and friendlier for the actor.
Also, Matt Libatique, the DP, who made his start with got his start with Darren Aronofsky doing, like, Requiem for a Dream and The Fountain and whatnot, is he's more of a cinematographer who wants to get it in the camera, and he does all sorts of things with framing tight or wider rather because he likes to blow up the film about 15% to mess with the grain structure and things like that. So I think that might also be, I don't know for sure because I didn't read the article in American Cinematographer, but it may have been him as well that might have wanted to just get it in camera and have it be solid.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you know, you can have that flexibility when you've got good actors to be improvising and to go off script, and to, especially when they know the characters pretty well. And I find that is absolutely, you know, where you notice that a director comes from an acting background, that they would give the actors that kind of flexibility. But by the same token, in the same film, we know that, as you said, Matt, Third Floor, for some of those action sequences, they were incredibly precisely previous. And then, of course, ironically, there's not much to film. Like in the China garden, Japanese garden sequence, where they've got effectively a robot fight sequence, where that's all digital. There are no men in suits for that. So you're basically shooting blank plates, lots of blank plates from all the angles that you know you can need. And I'm sure they shot coverage and stuff, but I also know that they shot very precisely to the previous, because hell, what else have you got to shoot to, right? You know, I mean, you've got nothing there, nor do you need to have anything there, because you know, ILM's going to come in and put that stuff in. So you just shoot lots of VistaVision plates that can be used and tracked and done. And, you know, now, yes, there are second unit stunt work and other occasions for that, but in that particular case of the Japanese garden sequence, it really is, which I've got to say did feel a little bit like a set piece to me. That was one of the only occasions that I felt like, hey, you're in a studio. Did anyone feel like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know it's the Stark Expo and they've gone into one of those hyper bubble thing gardens.
Guess, yeah, what did I expect it to look like, I guess?
Yeah, and it's at night, so, you know, they came up with all the story reasons how to hide all their sins, but yeah, definitely felt like a set piece.
I mean, I liked the, what do we think in the sequence, nowhere up the end in that fight sequence, there is a sequence where the robots go crazy and Iron Man is outnumbered, you know, 700-1. And I noticed that in some of the sequences where the camera work was following the digital interaction of the robots with the crowd scattering, there was some almost what you'd call, I don't know, Battlestar Galactica camera work where it would, you know, zoom inappropriately or not quite frame to get the action. And that was the only point in the film that I sort of noticed that type of camera work. Did anyone else notice that? It actually, you know, had that classic reframing on the fly as if a DOP was trying to get it but couldn't quite pull it off.
That's a pretty popular thing these days.
But it was only in that sequence.
They did They did the same kind of style in the first one, but the first one felt more like it was a documentary crew covering it. I mean, you know, when he flies in to rescue a town and he does that awesome fire of a rocket and blows up the tank in the first one. You know, that had that nice little pull focus and felt like you were...
That shot was the superhero shot of the first film for me. The one you're talking about, the tank blowing up behind him as he walks away and...
That was awesome. And I think one of the things that helped make that work was, you know, you've got practical environments there, so you're actually feeling those, you know, lens artifacts in there when we're pulling focus and stuff. Whereas the shots you're talking about, I think we're flying around and all CG, and I don't think it works as well trying to replicate a CG shot to make it look like there is some live action in there.
Sorry, I'm just laughing because somebody just handed me a note that I think I said that... when I was talking about the VersaTubes in that sequence, I don't know what number I quoted, but apparently there was 1,000 of them.
And you said 80.
Yeah, I think it was 80 fixtures. 1,000 tubes is what I was trying to say. So, yes, a few more than what I was indicating. Yes, but sorry, Matt. Yeah, look, I think the end sequence had some interesting aspects to it. You need a big finish on a film like this, and I'm never one to say they should cut it, but it's hard to make it really, really interesting because at a certain point you know that you know, he's not going to die. And I guess the only thing I would have expected is more peril to be placed on War Machine dying, because if War Machine was in real peril, then as a viewer, knowing that it's an Iron Man film, and I knowing in my case that there was a third film coming, I was in no doubt that Robert Downey Jr. was going to die, but I could totally buy that they might kill off War Machine. But that being said, there was great visual effects work in them not being particularly in peril.
This goes back to just my story problem. You know, Whiplash or whatever, you know, Mickey Rourke goes through this whole subversive thing behind Sam Rockwell's back to develop all the robots to be autonomous, and he's controlling all the robots and blah, blah, blah. Excuse me. And then they go to try and find him. He's not there. He flies in his super suit, and then in about three cuts, you know, they go, oh, right, do the double hand thing, and then they kill him. Like, it seemed a little anticlimactic in their fight with him.
Well, that, as I say, was a late change.
And they'd spent all their money on the lighting, so, you know, they couldn't...
Hey, so something really funny. I think I'm allowed to tell this story. I apologize immensely to my lawyers if I'm not. But you know the earlier court... This is just an aside. You know the court sequence where the US government is demanding that Robert Downey Jr. hand over the Iron Man suit, and they play that hysterical set of videos of other people's Iron Man suits from Korea and stuff going wrong. You know what I'm talking about, Jason?
Yeah, I really liked that.
Yeah, I really liked it. Apparently, and again, I hope this is not telling tales out of school, that was the pitch. Like, the pitch to get work on this film was you made a video to go in that section. As, you know, you didn't know what it was at the time, but it was like you have to make a video of someone trying to make an Iron Man suit going wrong, and that was like part of your pitching for the film. And if they really liked your video of things going wrong, then, you know, you stood a chance of being a facility that was I think Iron Man was always going to go to ILM for the primary work, but this is for the other houses. And I've got to say, I could have done with more of that. I could have done with a whole, I don't know, maybe on the web or on YouTube or something, but I thought those things were hysterically funny. And that was really just, as I understand it, people going crazy with, you know, creativity, because, of course, it didn't really matter. As long as the suit went wrong, there was no right or wrong.
That would have been a great viral marketing thing. And they had a huge viral marketing thing at Comic-Con and stuff for this film. But, yeah, that would have been awesome.
Wasn't that good? I just thought they were so hysterically funny, those things. And
my favorite one was the Sam Rockwell one, where the guy turns around, like the machine turns around halfway, and you hear like a little crunch, and then Rockwell has to say, by the way, that operator, he was fine. He was fine. Yeah. Nothing happened to him.
I know. Ever since Moon, Sam Rockwell can do no wrong by me. He's just great.
He's always been great, yeah.
And he has, I will say this, he also had a nice kind of believable aspect to him, in the sense that he wasn't the uber evil genius that, you know, could outwit, outlast, and out-survive everybody else. I mean, he was, you know, doing things wrong and screwing up with things, and... you know, I thought it was good. I don't know how he's going to play out in the third one, but I hope he comes back, because I thought he was good. And we just should finish out by mentioning the stuff that happened with the Black Widow sequence. She, you know, has that great sequence at the end, the fight sequence and stuff.
I thought her fight sequences were really well coordinated, actually.
I thought so, too. I thought it was just brilliantly edited, that sequence.
Yeah, it's really believable, and there's only a couple times in, like, reverses where you could tell, like, the hair was a little different, and it was a stunt person. But for the most part, I know Scarlett Johansson did a lot of her own effects. They had an overhead...
wire rig, yeah.
Overhead wire rig. And I thought from a fight standpoint, they were really solidly edited, nice and tight, and not, like, two or three different angles, not, like, that really close inside editing where you can't see the action.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want that stuff where you go, look, and this is my pet thing at the moment, I just hate it when you go, I can't understand what's going on, so just let me know when the fight's over and I'm sure no one will be left standing. And that just wasn't the case. You know, I got the choreography of what was going on. I understood, obviously in some cases there were people appearing just around the corner and I didn't necessarily know that they were, you know, as she didn't, where they were coming from. But it didn't matter. It all made sense. She clobbered them. She wiped him out. It was funny.
You know, it was a good sequence, but after seeing Kick-Ass's fight sequence, it's just, you know.
And Kick-Ass, man.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
So. Oh, Race Out. That's been my big film of this year. That's my favorite film so far. I'm looking forward to it being topped if it can be.
But I did like that Favreau's character as the driver spent the entire fight scene fighting one guy.
Yeah, what's his name? Is his name Lucky or what's his?
Yeah, Happy. Lucky.
Happy. Thank
Happy.
You.
Lucky.
Happy.
Happy go lucky.
Yeah, and then he knocks the guy out. He's like, "All right, I did it." And there's like 80 guys. You know, it's like that's Favreau's. You know, he's a comedian for the most part in a lot of his acting, and I think he brings a lot of that to the filmmaking.
I don't know the guy, but I just feel like he's the nicest guy, and I just wish him like all the success in the world because honestly, he seems to be producing great films. He seems to be an respectful of the actors. He's not, you know, going all out, but he's collaborative. In the ILM discussion with Ben, so we actually got onto this, where he was saying he would really be like, so what do you reckon should happen here? Like, you know, he wouldn't be abdicating his directorial responsibilities, but he would actually be collaborating with ILM. And I just think that's brilliant. The more that we could get of that, the better. I mean, any director that can nail it and not be an arrogant prick.
Yeah, and understands that his film's being driven by VFX. And in the credits, it's reflected as well. A lot of the VFX credits are at the top of the credit roll.
And look, that shot of Robert Downey Jr. in the Randy's Donut, I mean, that is just superb compositing, superb 3D. I mean, that's a chance where you can just see, like, the guy is not in a suit. I challenge anyone to say that looks fake. That's like Sid Graff level. Oh my God, you guys have totally nailed it. And there is some really good stuff going on there with the computer graphics. But
I thought they just craned him up into the donut, honestly. I thought he was sitting in the donut.
No, that's a digital suit in the donut. He never on set, on screen, had a full digital suit. Full real suit. They had a digital suit. A real suit to match for digital on set. But as I understand it, and I wasn't there, of course, there was no shot that had the reference suit as the hero suit. And so I think you'll find in that shot, he's even various parts of his limbs were digitally replaced because, you know, to give his body the kind of width that it needed when you added the suit on, he may have not given enough space around it. And, you know, let's face it, like ILM, and they now are using the energy conserving models and doing some really elaborate stuff. We get into this a bit with Ben Sum, and I guess I shouldn't go into it all now, but a lot of environment mapping work, I'll just give you one little geek out moment. A lot of the environment mapping work is to say, well, I'll get like an HDR, a high dynamic range image of the scene, and I map that to a sphere, and then I put my CG in the sphere, and of course it benefits from having the lighting reference at every direction from having taken an onset 360 degree spherical reading. In other words, I take a bunch of fisheyes at a point where the CG is going to be. It shows me what the environment is and what lights are contributing at that point, whether they be real lights or just bounce light. And then when I put my CG in there, it inherits all of that. That's standard now at the high end. What's amazing about the work that DD did with Benjamin Button and also ILM's doing with this is that they're no longer making that an infinite sphere. They're actually making it what's called finite lights, the distance is actually mapped to real versions of the real lights. And this actually makes the maths way more complicated and more difficult. But what it gives you is the kind of realism we see in this, the kind of realism we saw in DD with Benjamin Button. And it's superb technical stuff. I mean, it really is. It's energy conserving. It's filtered important sampling with HDRs. And what you get with these finite HDR lighting rigs is just off the dial. Now, not everybody works this way. Weta, for example, isn't doing this exact same technique. They've got some other really cool techniques, and I'm by no means saying this is the only way to go, but it's the advances at the hardcore top of the line in the render equations and in the render modelers, lighting models that they're working with at the moment are just producing magnificent results. But boy, this is not plug and play. We're way beyond that.
What's nice about that is that it seems like, you know, from the original method, it seems like a nice logical extension to say, okay, we're working with this infinite source. Let's actually step it down. I'm saying regardless of complexity here, I'm not even going to get into the complexity. I'm just saying from a logical follow through, let's see if we can actually accommodate all the lights in their actual locations seems like a nice forward motion in the process.
I mean, it makes no difference virtually mathematically in the Randy's Donut scene because the sun is, for all intents and purposes, an infinite distance away. And so if you think about it, if you drew a line from his shoulder and a line from his toes, they're both going to go in the same angle to the sun. In other words, by the time the light is getting to his body, it's parallel. The light coming into his shoulder is arriving at the same vector angle as the one at his toes. Now, if you want to see this really played out well, go to the kitchen sequence of Iron Man, because now a light above his head would hit his shoulder at 30 degrees and his toes at 60 degrees, and it makes a big difference that the lights are no longer assumed mathematically to be infinitely far away, but are in fact physically constrained to be only a meter away from his head and 2 meters away from his feet. And yet, in terms of how we approach this mathematically, this wasn't something we could really handle even a few years ago, like a couple of years ago. And so if you're going to SIGGRAPH, I pray this is the case, I'm pretty sure it is, these guys will be talking about this stuff at some of the SIGGRAPH conferences coming up at the end of July. We're certainly going to SIGGRAPH, and it is really like the cutting edge of realism, but man, is it do your head in maths, because once you can no longer assume an HDR map to an infinite source and start getting finite spaces, you get the right shadowing, the right properties of occlusion, but boy, is it really interesting to do. There you go, I geeked out. we got to wind it up at that point. I normally thank you, Matt, but I'm going to get you to do the thanks this week. Matt actually cuts the show for us and does a tremendous job, but if you could thank your co-producer for me.
Yeah, Todd Skoulton does all the research for us, and he rocks, so big thanks to you, Todd.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, man. And I want to thank you, Jason, for coming in. We had some scheduling clashes and time zone problems, and you stepped up, and we really appreciate it. We
thanks
always
for having me.
Like talking to you. Especially as you've stayed up till like midnight. Matt, thank you for not only being here, but for what you're about to do to resurrect the editing on this.
Pleasure.
And thank you guys for listening. We're obviously into our new century of shows, and we're going to be doing more of the same. We're going to be upping some of the technical aspects of the VFX show and trying to, as we do today, include some aspect of filmmaking in the discussion, and that's the feedback we've been getting from you. More of the same, but with a bit more of a technical insight, and hopefully you guys will respond. We have phenomenal downloads on this show, so I really do appreciate all your time and effort, and a big shout out to the guys that worked at all the facilities that worked on this film, because I think outstanding. I hope this goes into Oscar nomination for VFX. I'm sure it will now that they've upped it to 5 categories for the VFX, and I think it's great work. So congratulations to everybody, and thank you guys so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.